Hey, this is Colin Edwards for the Yamaha Factory Moto GP team. You're listening to Moto GP OD.
The lights are on red. We'll go.
GP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. It's December 25th, and this is episode number 72.
This is the Christmas special edition, coming to you live on Christmas morning. I'm sitting in with Pop Monkey and I am Moto Liam, and we're here at the Canvas Cafe in San Francisco. It's a beautiful sunny day. It's approximately beer o'clock, and we're discussing motorcycle racing. So if you're in the area and you want to have a beer or a salad or coffee, God forbid, 10th and Lincoln is the place to go. You might even see MotoGP personnel.
Okay, we have an excellent show for you today featuring interviews with Colin Edwards of the Yamaha MotoGP factory racing team, Andrew Wheeler, a freelance MotoGP photographer, as well as two super cool and informative pieces by David Emmett of the Kropotkin Thinks blog. Before we begin, a few quick administrative notes. First, if you have comments about the show, don't be shy. Contact the MotoGP OD team by emailing motogpod@motogpod.com. And if you'd like to reach me directly, my email is popmonkey, that's popmonkey@motogpod.com. Second, I am still working on getting the right gear together to bring the quality of my episode somewhere closer to where it was under Bob Hayes. But it's going to take a little while, so for now, apologies for the sometimes poor sound. And thanks for your patience. I would also like to give a huge shout-out to Bob and his buds in Iraq. Happy holidays, guys, and Happy New Year as well. All right, let's get to it. First up, David Emmett recorded his summation of the preseason so far. David and I bumped into each other virtually in the RideOn2.com forums about halfway through the 2006 season. His blog, Kropotkin Thinks, is an outstanding resource. When the ball got rolling on reviving the MotoGP OD podcast in November, I contacted David to see if he would be interested in submitting content to MotoGP OD. He was willing to give it a shot, and I think you'll agree with me that this was very fortunate. You'll hear for yourself. Here's his summary of the 2007 preseason so far. Take it away, David.
The Valencia MotoGP race is always tough on race fans. Once the last race of the season is done, we face the prospect of a long, dark winter without motorcycle racing. Thankfully, this year we've had something special to console us. The arrival of the 800s and their first serious head-to-head tests. Normally, the winter tests are a pretty cerebral affair, with teams tweaking their bikes for incremental improvement. But the rules are changing for 2007, and it's a whole new ball game. Theoretically, everyone starts with a clean sheet and on equal footing. But, in general, theory tends not to survive very long out in the real world. What we were afraid of was Honda walking all over everyone, as they had done after the change to the four-strokes in 2002. Honda and HRC had pushed through the capacity change to 800cc, and the conspiracy theorists like to point out that HRCC had a 990cc V5, which is an 800cc V4 with an extra cylinder. What's more, Nicky Hayden had spent all year developing the chassis to be used for the 800 and had even managed to win the world title on it. All they had to do was take the RC211V Evo engine, remove one cylinder, slide the new V4 into Hayden's chassis, and the title would be theirs for the taking. Only this time, of course, with Danny Pedrosa aboard, as the plan had been all along. Well, I'm glad to say that the three tests held so far have not gone entirely to plan for HRC. So far, at Valencia, Sepang and Jerez, the Hondas have not looked anything like the all-conquering machines we were expecting. What's more, when Holden built the new bike, they didn't take the quick route which everyone expected. They changed the chassis quite a bit, making the bike shorter, more compact. This has made the RC212V flickable, which is good for going into the corners, but twitchy, which makes it harder to hold the higher corner speeds the 800s need. Then there's the engine. It's down on power by a worryingly large amount. Nicky Hayden, Tony Elias, Marco Melandri and Carlos Checa have all complained about the lack of power from the Honda, and it shows in their times. They've generally been running behind the Suzukis and the Yamahas, not at all where they want to be, and not where we expected them. Hayden has already said he'll have a tough time defending his title in 2007, and looking at the lap time so far, that could be quite an understatement. The only rider not becalmed in the Honda doldrums is Dani Pedrosa, who has topped the timesheets at both Valencia and Jerez. This seems to fit in very nicely with the HRC plan. Build a tiny bike, put Tiny Danny on board, and go win another title. However, if you look at the full timesheets for the Jerez tests, it shows a different picture. Danny takes the fastest time, but he only does it on a hot lap using a qualifier. There's lots of reasons to put on a qualifier, but you don't win races with a single fast lap. You need to go fast lap after lap. If you check the Jerez times for the Suzukis and for Rossi, you'll see them put in long strings of 141s in run after run. Looking at Pedrosa's longer runs, he puts in a couple of 141s, but also plenty of 142s. Chris Vermeulen put in two runs with a sequence of 9 laps in the 141 bracket on the Suzuki. Pedrosa never managed more than 3 in a row. So it looks like we could see Pedrosa get a bunch of poles next year, then spend the race trying not to lose too many places to the bikes which are faster on race tyres. Despite the plan, Pedrosa and HRC don't seem to have the title in the bag just yet. But Suzuki may have. At test after test, on day after day, John Hopkins and Chris Vermeulen have been at or near the front of the pack. That's quite a surprise, because since Suzuki entered MotoGP, they have signally failed to set the world on fire. The Suzuki GSVR 990 never really looked capable of much more than a top 7 finish. Kenny Roberts Jr. wasn't prepared to risk crashing by pushing too hard just to get 5th. Hopper was. He would try and ride the wheels off the bike, but he also ended up crashing a lot more. So, it's a surprise for the Suzukis to come out with the new 800 and run at the front right from the off. Paul Denning said they spent a lot of this year preparing for 2007, developing things on the 990 which they aim to use on the 800. This strategy really seems to have paid off. The Suzuki always had corner speed, but was short on drive and top end. Corner speed is going to be the key to next year's title race, so now that outright horsepower is less of a factor, the Suzukis are poised to take a few wins. If I had cash to spare on a wager, I'd be laying money on one of the Suzuki boys to finish top 3 in the championship next year. Of course, if you could only lay a single bet, the safest bet is still Valentino Rossi to take the championship. He won 5 races in 2006, but still lost the title. Probably the main reason for this was he didn't seem to be concentrating during pre-season testing, dividing his time and attention between MotoGP and Formula 1. The lack of focus cost him very dear. The chatter problems, which Yamaha didn't find during testing, probably cost Rossi the race in Shanghai, and probably the Laguna Seca round as well. It's inconceivable that Rossi would make the same mistake again, but there have already been mutterings about Rossi missing the Sepang test to race in the New Zealand WRC rally. But, despite his foray into the world of four wheels, I don't think he's being distracted this time. Just looking at the bike and his gear, you can tell Rossi is on a mission. He has an Excalibur theme going on his fairing and his helmet. I dismissed this on my blog as historically inaccurate. As Excalibur is not the sword which Arthur pulled from the stone and made him king, Excalibur was the sword Arthur received from the Lady of the Lake after he broke the sword in the stone in a fight. Someone left a comment that Rossi did get it right after all. His M1 was broken in battle with Hayden last year, and so he's been given a new weapon in the shape of an 800cc Yamaha with which to regain his crown. I like that analogy. Looking at the times, Rossi is closest to the Suzukis when you look at the long runs rather than the headline fastest laps. What's more, Colin Edwards is not far behind either. Edwards was a long way behind Rossi for much of 2006, as all of Yamaha's efforts were put into fixing Rossi's bike to defend his title, rather than helping Edwards get his bike more competitive. So far, though, Edwards' times have been much closer to Rossi's. That means that the Yamaha 800 is a pretty good bike, so Edwards could be in for a much better year than 2006. The other team which everyone expected to do well was Ducati. They got their 800cc GP7 bike out very early, running public tests as early as May, and have obviously already put a lot of work in it. And frankly, it seems as if the engine and chassis are pretty well sorted. At Valencia, Casey Stoner and Loris Caparossi ran decent times, Stoner looking especially good on a bike he'd only just climbed aboard. But at Jerez, they seem to have lost their way. They spent much of the test struggling with the software, and failing to get it to do what they wanted. What I found interesting was that Alex Barros was quicker than Caparossi and Stoner, despite being on an older version of the GP7. but he was probably running an older, more stable version of the engine management software, making it easier to concentrate on setting the bike up rather than battling the computer bugs. I write software for a living, so I felt Capirossi's pain. Well, speaking of betting, Alex Barros might be worth a flutter too. He's a great pick for your fantasy MotoGP team, because he's going to be cheap because of Dantin's terrible season in 2006. But Barros will be on very similar machinery to the factory Ducati team this year, and on the same tyres. He's not going to be fighting for the win every race, but I see him getting at least one podium this year. Two teams which I don't see getting podiums are Kawasaki and Ilmor. Kawasaki have long had a strong French connection, as Kawasaki France dominated endurance racing for years and years. And now, the French have turned up in MotoGP, as Team Kawasaki will have an all-French lineup for next year, with veteran Olivier Jacques and young gun Randy Depunier. But the only outing for Kawasaki's 0800 has not looked good so far. OJ turned up at Sepang, rode the 990 on the first day of testing, then took the 800 out on the second day, only to wrap up early and miss the third day after the 800 turned out to be in a bit of a state. The bike had a whole mess of mechanical problems and looks like being a very long way from competitive. As for Ilmor, well, the X3, or X-cubed, or whatever, is still at least a second, maybe two, off the pace. Ilmor finally announced their team lineup, naming Jeremy McWilliams and Andrew Pitt as their riders for next year. This is no real surprise, as both men tested the bike both at Valencia and Jerez, but you've got to feel sorry for McCoy. Neither McWilliams nor Pitt were significantly faster than Gary McCoy, who rode the bike during the race at Valencia. What's more, McWilliams had a big crash on the last day of testing at Jerez, breaking a leg and losing the top of a finger. At 42, it takes longer to recover from that sort of incident than at 22. The press release talks about both McWilliams and Pitt being experienced at developing a bike, which is why they've been hired, but that can also be read as a tacit admission that they don't expect to be taking home any silverware next season. That leaves one team we haven't seen at the tests, Team KR with Kenny Roberts Jr. Reason is pretty simple. They were probably given an 800 engine too late, and don't have a working chassis for it. Add to this the fact that they ran without a sponsor last year, or at least not a sponsor that actually exists other than on the pages of a film script, and it seems pretty clear that the team is running under very tight financial constraints. Which is a real pity, as Kenny Jr. seems to have rediscovered his pleasure in racing this year, and his dad's bike looked pretty good. I hope they don't get off to a slow start like they did last year, but it's looking like that's what's going to happen, sadly. So, that's what's been happening and not happening in the test so far. The riders now have a break as a result of the winter test ban, but they'll be back in action on January 22nd, back in Sepang, Malaysia. If you want to look at the Jerez timesheets, you can find them at www.crono-jerez.com/2006/MGP test/. Now that Crono Jerez is CRONO-JEREZ, without the H. Now, back to Jules.
Thanks, David. That was sweet. Now I'd like to say a word about the guy without whom the MotoGP OD return would not have been possible. That is Liam Schubert. Liam and I hung out in San Francisco last week. We drank beers for breakfast and talked about MotoGP and MotoGP OD. In addition to helping out in general, he also provided content by hooking us up with all sorts of MotoGP people, some of whom took time out of their holiday schedule to talk with us for this episode. Hopefully, Liam will be able to continue to be a big part of this podcast. In any case, thanks a lot, bro. Okay, so with that said, we've now got the Colin Edwards interview with Moto Liam, and here's what they talked about.
For this special Christmas episode of the MotoGP OD podcast, we're sitting in with Colin Edwards II, Yamaha factory racer, and currently teammate to Valentino Rossi. Good morning, Colin. Thanks for being here.
Hey, what's happening, man? Yeah, just hanging out, watching some cartoons with the kids, you know, normal stuff.
Normal stuff. Do you have any? Do you watch cartoons in Europe also when you guys were in the motorhome?
Oh yeah, man. We're big on Dora the Explorer and Johnny Bravo, you know.
Oh, Johnny Bravo. Cool.
That's it.
I like Johnny Bravo myself. Cartoon Network. Good stuff. Do you run satellite TV when you're out there?
Yeah, we got, I think that's the only way to go nowadays, isn't it? It's on the motorhome, occasionally you have a problem here and there, but it's pretty smooth. Get all the channels.
And I noticed you've got a motorhome driver that takes it takes your motorhome from race to race. How did you meet up with him?
Yeah, when we bought our first motorhome, we the AV company that put the TVs and the satellite in England, in London. It was just their younger son, basically. Uh-huh. He's the guy who drives a motorhome, but it's I did enough of my penance or whatever you want to call it. I did enough time behind the wheel. I said, screw this, I got a family and I need to get home when I can and give him the keys and let him drive.
Right, especially, what are you going to do when you've got a flyaway? You don't want to be thinking, oh, I got to babysit the motorhome.
Yeah, exactly, and it was turning into that, like in 2003 when I was with Aprilia. With one kid with Gracie, it wasn't that bad, but it just got to where, you're babysitting the motorhome, trying to run it one place and then fly to the next place and worry about what Alicia was doing, and it just turned into a pain in the ass. So I just said, I need a driver and make it a lot easier.
Totally. Don't they call him Mr. Paddock?
Mr. Paddock. That's
Mr.
it.
Paddock.
Yep. he won the Mr. Paddock, and I said, that's funny, because you're like the super nice guy, Mr. Paddock. But for some reason, girls don't like nice guys.
They never
they
do.
They like the bad boys.
They never do. Now, the last we were drinking, I saw you at the party in Estoril after that race.
Yep.
And what were your feelings on the championship after you saw that? I mean...
Estoril was probably one of the races, I'd say the only race of the year that I laid down, I had to help my teammate out as much as I could, and it worked out. It worked out good. All he had to do was win the race. He just missed it by, 2,000ths or something, so.
Yeah.
After the race, I think everybody was a bit bummed that he didn't actually win it. I was a bit bummed that I didn't get on the podium, but at the end of the day, he was sitting in a good position, so, after that, yeah. I felt like, I had done the job that I really had to, the one job,
right.
In the year that I really had to do, and stepped up and kind of helped out a bit.
How did it feel to be battling with Kenny Roberts Jr.?
Yeah, it was good. Kenny and I go way back from 250
yeah.
days, and it was fun.
He hasn't been up with you.
Yeah, a couple races we get together here and there. This year obviously I wasn't happy running, fifth, sixth, eighth, whatever I was running, but it had to be that way. So we had a pretty good battle there at Estoril. So
do you think that because you guys have such a history and you've been racing each other so long, can you kind of anticipate what you think he's going to do in certain corners? Or
It's a hell of a lot different than, going out your local club race. You go to a club race, you don't know a lot of the guys, and you can't trust
right.
any of the guys.
Hmm.
I think the biggest thing with, Grand Prix riders is, even though we hadn't grown up, some of the riders hadn't grown up with, I just started racing them a couple of years ago, but there's just a certain level of trust,
yeah.
That we all understand what could happen. So there's a level of trust that everybody has in one another. You don't do anything too crazy. You can pull some block passes here and there, but you don't completely turn the brain off just a little.
Right. Well, I guess speaking of block passes and Hail Mary passes, you were watching when Tony Elias came across the track at the end of the straightaway at Estoril.
Holy shit, dude, that was crazy.
You just said there's a certain level of trust, but certain riders maybe haven't been haven't been racing for...
Tony, he's always been really good on the brakes, and when he passed me the first time going down the back straight, I was going to grab the brakes, and he was still accelerating by me, and I thought, bye bye, see ya,
yeah.
On the flip side, and he locked the thing up and got it in the corner. I was like, holy, how the hell did he do that?
Yeah, I think even the video clearly shows how deep you guys were going in. I was blown away. I was watching, I think, from pit wall, and it was just like, whoa!
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Did you... I think I heard somewhere that the bike, as the chassis changed this year, 2006, you kept getting better and better pieces, or maybe you were not getting exactly the same stuff as Valentino. In the last couple of races, did you find, a noticeable improvement in the bike?
Yeah, I mean, the last few races, I got some new stuff, you know. It was, I think my year was compounded when, you know, as soon as Valentino had his first problem. Then basically all effort focused toward, getting Valentino back in the winner's circle, and I suffered some of the consequences. Last year, as in 05, was a lot different. It was kind of, he'd get something, and the next race I'd get it, and then he'd get something else, and the next race I'd get it. So this year was quite a bit different. I just kind of got put on the back burner, and I wasn't happy about it, but I understood what problems they were having, what they were trying to do. But, at the end of the day, it still didn't work out. I still finished second in the championship.
But that's his championship. For you, we'll just come back to you. You've got the bike and the ride for 07 with Yamaha.
Yeah.
And is it basically the same chassis that you developed this year with, say, an 800 engine in it?
I would venture to say yes. I know. I know exactly what it is, but it's the same, I'm not sure. But it is. I would say it's 95%, but this year's chassis, the thing is we still complained at the end of the year about the chassis. It just seemed like it was peaks and valleys. One day it worked, one day it didn't work at the same track. And Valentino would say the same thing. At Valencia on the Saturday, it worked great. On the Sunday, he couldn't hit his ass with both hands.
Wow.
So it was, we always thought it was a chassis problem, which... At the end of the day, it wasn't chassis problem, it was engine problem. Once we put an 800 in there and you get rid of all that big torque and that big hit, thing turned into a dream to ride.
Ah, yeah. You had a great preseason down at it's a Pang.
The bike's been good. I mean, with the 800 there, there are a couple things you say, I want more bottom end grind, more this, more that. But I think as far as a total package, initial package, it's really good. I think the only initial package that can compete with us, I think, right now is Suzuki. Suzuki guys got a really good package as well.
But you've got Michelins, and I think that might be a better factor in your favor. I mean, I know you've been a Michelin guy for so long.
I'm so excited about next year. They got Michelin been working their ass off the last few tests here, and we come up with some things, some ideas, and I mean, if you ask me, we've gone light years ahead just in the last couple tests with Michelin.
They always seem to advance with anytime Bridgestone or anybody else takes a step forward, Michelin makes a bigger jump, okay, then we'll go five steps forward, and it takes everybody else time.
Exactly. I think with Michelin, we've been, been a little bit stagnant, I guess the last 3 or 4 years, we kind of got a tire and it works, and they've been winning the championship with Valentino, and there's some Bridgestone come out every now and then and work good, but now that Bridgestone are starting to really be more consistent, they've made a big jump, and I'm really happy with it.
Perfect. Would you ever ride for another tire manufacturer?
No, that wouldn't be my choice, At the end of the day, it's all about what bike you get a ride on,
Yeah.
I mean, there was a time in my career whenever I went and rode Aprilia, and the only reason I went to ride there was if they brought Michelin with them. It kind of worked out good because they wanted Michelin. I was in good with Michelin, and with some bargaining and some bartering, we finally got Michelin on the Aprilia. So whereas any other rider asking for Michelins, it might not have happened. But just the long history that I had with them, it seemed to go pretty smoothly.
Yeah, I've noticed that you've got a real strong connection. I saw that weird leather suit dryer that they set up for you in Sepang in Malaysia. That kind of air pump thing. I mean, was that something that you said, or was that something that Speedy said, hey, this is a good idea, let's dry your suit out like this?
No, that's been around for decades, man. I mean, that's an old Suzuki 8-hour trick.
Okay.
I mean, they've had that at Suzuki since the day I can remember. Basically, you get off the bike, and you only got about 45 minutes before you have to get dressed again.
Right.
So they got these big fans in and with a big sleeve off of it, and just put the sleeve in the neck of the suit, and it, I mean, within 5-10 minutes, the thing's completely dry.
Wow.
Yeah. So that I said, you know, that's an idea. We need that. I'm tired of hanging it out in the sun, and then you got to put it on the fan, and you're always burning fans up because you know it's not getting any circulation. So it's like,
right.
Why don't we actually do something about this?
I just thought it looked really cool because I think if they, you know, could paint a helmet or do something, it could be like a little virtual guy.
Yeah, or, yeah.
You know, just a neat idea for kids and fans to watch. Hey, here's a question for you. Now that, on my own team, Alex Barros is coming back into MotoGP, and it seems like Caparossi is in his 30s, Junior's in his 30s, you're in your 30s. There's definitely a bunch of guys in their 30s, and then you've got the young kids, like the Danny Pedrosa, the Casey Stoner, Elias. You know, they all seem to be from the same racing generation, whereas you and Kenny are from the same generation. Do you feel like when you're riding, do you think, oh, you know what? I'm going to show you what's up, kid. Or do you ever think in terms of age, or do you just see a number, and or anybody on the track is just a number to you?
No, I mean, you know, these, you know, you say kids, but a lot of these kids have won multiple championships. So it's not, you know, it's not like just some young punk kid comes in there and starts going good. But I think you all the guys that are there have earned the respect that you know that they deserve anyway. So it's, you know, I don't ever look at it as like, you know, I'm gonna show you what's up because I'm. You know, you got more experience or whatever. I never really look at it like that. I look at it all this as one. I just believe I'm a better rider, and if I am, then I'm gonna beat your ass. Just like that. But I mean, as far as the young kids, you've got, you know, I mean, we're gonna have to make room here in the next year or two. You got Dovizioso, Lorenzo. You know, some of the younger kids, DeAngelis as well, I mean, all these guys are going to come up to Grand Prix sooner or later, and the only way they're going to come up is for some of those older guys to go away. So it's going to be interesting, I think, here in the next year, 2 years.
Yeah, I have to agree. Now, I remember reading somewhere that you said you didn't really train, like you don't have a full-on exercise routine, you know, like a personal trainer. Do you find now that you're in your 30s that, you know, maybe I do need to kind of do something.
Well, it's funny because, you know, up to this point, I mean, I've got motocross, and, you know, I do what I want to do to have fun. I mean, I can drink 100 beers or drink no beer, and I'm still 150 pounds. You know, it doesn't, I'm blessed with good genes from my mom, I guess. But now, you know, since I got back from Tesla, I mean, I've been playing tennis just about every damn day. But purposely running my ass off. I'm like, hit the ball over there, hit it over there, you know, make me run. So it's, you know, I've been doing my own sweating here in the last few weeks and enjoying it, you know, just enjoying getting back on the tennis court. I did a lot in high school and get back doing something active, you know, constantly.
And are you still riding any moto, any dirt?
You know, I haven't done any motocross in quite a while. And for what reason, I know. And then the last time I went and rode was probably, I don't know, 8 months, a year ago, and I just, you know, I don't know. I went out on the day and I couldn't slow down. You know, I mean, as a racer, you want to go out there and, I mean, I come from a long history of motocross, so.
I know.
You know, I was out there doing all the triples and blazing through the whoops, and I come in and I was like, man, this is, I can't, you know, I'm just going too fast. And I want to slow down, but I couldn't slow down. And so then I came in after about 20 minutes and said, that's it. I loaded the bike up and left. I was like, if I continue with this, I'm going to, something's going to happen.
Set yourself up for the bad deal.
Yeah. So I just said, you know what? I can always come back to this anytime I want. It's just need to chill out a bit.
Yeah. Take a step back. Colin, I just want to say thanks for your time and have Merry Christmas and happy holidays to Alyssa and Gracie and everyone else. Okay.
All right, amigo, you got it. We'll check you later.
See you at the races.
Next up, we also talk to Andrew Wheeler. Andrew is a freelance photographer who is often at MotoGP, World Superbike, and AMA events. He had some very interesting things to say and is a fun guy to talk to. Check it out.
Hi, we're sitting in with Andrew Wheeler, who is a professional photographer that follows the MotoGP race series, as well as World Superbike events, and many more, including events in the AMA. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Liam.
And where are you located now?
I'm currently based on the West Coast in California, near Laguna Seca.
Ah, okay. And how many days a year would you say that you travel to follow and photograph racing?
I would say it's approximately every... Events happen every 2 weeks, and over the course of a weekend, from travel to return home is approximately 5 days.
Okay. So you make all the MotoGP events as well as the testing, and then I know you do AMA work.
Actually, sorry, I'd better stop you there. I actually primarily do AMA, and then I do a handful of MotoGP, so...
How long have you been photographing motorcycles?
A little over 3 years.
And did you do action sports photography before that?
Yeah, I was actually... I started out as a professional horse photographer.
Ah. And just for one reason or another, you got attracted to motorcycling and...
No, I've always loved motorcycles. Actually, the reason I got into photographing motorcycles was actually my wife's fault. She suggested one winter when the money wasn't coming in that we had one of those talks that I perhaps would maybe want to think about either getting a proper job or actually going and taking photographs of something else. And she suggested that I go and take photographs of the testing that was going on at Laguna Seca one early January. And really, that's where it started off.
Amazing. Now, do you work primarily for magazines as a freelancer, or do you have a... like a main person you work with or a main distribution? I know you have your own company, automotophoto.com. Do you take care of all your travel? I mean, give us some background so that people can say, oh, wow, if I wanted to do something similar, not to be competition, but if they wanted to do something similar, what advice could you give or what kind of background information could you give as to how you went about doing things?
Well, I think the fact that I'd already been working in the equine horse field certainly helped with regards to how I generated business. I'm totally freelance. I do contract work from time to time with Road Racer X, but generally it's Cycle World. I've supplied work to Performance Bikes in the UK, Motorcycle Racer in the UK. I'm currently negotiating with a couple of TV companies in Europe with regards to supplying images for the AMA, believe it or not. It's sad to say, but it's one of those jobs that you have to, in essence, you create your own work schedule. Fund yourself to some degree because there's so many people that want to do this and you can't blame them because it's obviously an interesting occupation, but really your work should speak for itself and subsequently there's a lot of people out there. You have to rise above that and you have to be able to supply images that people want to use, and they have to be compelling. That's how I feel anyway. It's tough. I think I'm fortunate in the fact that, you know, one half of the team, my wife, also loves motorcycles probably as much as I do. And like I said, she was the one that got me into this, so blame her.
She's also a photographer?
No, she's, believe it or not, she's a writer, she's an English teacher and an HR professional, believe it or not, but she's written a number of motorcycle racing articles. She used to do the PR for Laguna Seca many years ago, and she's a bike freak.
Ah, well, it's always good to have those in the family because when the passion runs the same, the wheels tend to roll easier.
Absolutely.
Well, As far as making travel arrangements to go to the overseas races, do you just, you know, contact a company and say, I need a plane, a rental car, and you know, I need to rent a hotel somewhere? Or is there some kind of structure or organization that you use, maybe a network where you say, oh, I'm going to call another photographer and maybe we'll get a room together? Or because I think that's pretty scary for Americans that don't really travel very much. Just even to go and visit a race, it's daunting.
Well, for me, I was long before I met my wife, I was one of those solo travelers. I traveled around Europe on my own motorcycle by myself for a number of months, and so traveling independently hasn't been a problem. It's just a question of being organized. When I travel abroad to the Grand Prix races, I prefer to rent a house personally because I like to be able to get away from the crowds in the evening and just have some quiet time. So I've been fortunate in every race that I've gone to, I've been able to find a house to rent pretty close to the track. I mean, for example, at the Italian Grand Prix this year, I was able to secure a house in the town of Scarperia itself, and it was... Oh. It only took 5 minutes to get to the track, and then on the Sunday, it took like 3 hours to get back to the house. But, you know, for example, Phillip Island, I rented a house that was just at the end of the where you turn off for the track. I rented a house there. So I've been fortunate in renting houses. Flights are not really an issue. I tend to book my stuff out well in advance once I've decided what I'm going to do and cover. And whether or not I can actually, to be honest, whether a race is going to produce images that are, in my opinion, valuable and will be used. For example, races like Mugello, Phillip Island, certain races, I think, in my opinion, create better images than others, visually.
Yes, I'd have to agree. After seeing them myself, some are just so majestic and everything kind of clicks, either with the weather I think certain racetracks bring out a different attitude in the riders, either due to the fans or the significance of the race.
Right.
And when that kind of motivation and ambiance is there, that's when really special images take place. Mugello this year was a fantastic experience for me. I love the special paint schemes. I couldn't believe the enormity of the crowds.
The crowds are mad.
Yes, definitely.
Totally mad. It was bizarre watching somebody over rev a lawnmower. I mean, and over rev a scooter and hit rev limiters and then throwing gasoline down trumpets of things that they've made and yeah, it was quite something. The trouble was I went down with flu as well, so it wasn't the ideal situation either.
In the 3 years that you've been going to motorcycle races to photograph, is there one race or one experience that stands out? And it could be either on track or maybe a dinner you had with somebody or a conversation. Is there something that you think, wow, that was really interesting or really special?
Well, I would say, let me give you two examples. One has... for me that's always stuck in my mind was the meeting with or just stood by Valentino Rossi at Phillip Island last year. I got down to Parc Fermé before the crowds got there, and he came in, he did his little burnout just outside Parc Fermé, rushed in, and I was stood by the Yamaha, by his crew, and he rushes over And the boyish exuberance blew me away. And in fact, to be honest, I stopped taking photographs because I just wanted to enjoy the moment for me. That was a special moment, just witnessing that. For the AMA, I've always had a soft spot for Neil Hallström, believe it or not. And sadly, he's not with us next year. But the guy is, in my opinion, pretty classy and such a great rider to watch ride. I mean, he's all over the bike. He just tries to get as much out of that machine as he could this year. And to me, that just watching Neil do his business is that sounds a bit dodgy, but sounds pretty good in my is something to behold.
Yeah, I would agree. He's always impressed me either in his interviews and in his on-camera presence. And, yeah, I'm sure the AMA is sad to see him go.
I think so. But, I'm surprised he just right now doesn't have a ride for next year. That's the big shocker for me.
Do you feel that he would ride for Carl Fogarty next year if they came up with a suitable sponsor?
I don't know. I mean, personally, in all honesty, I try to not take in too much of the politics of this sport because I kind of like to go with a clean slate when I photograph stuff. But I mean, you never know how much of the rumblings with regards to rivalries or whether somebody doesn't like someone or not. That to me is not important. I mean, I mean, it would be nice to see Neil ride a bike. It would be nice to see him. People work things out. But for me, I just tend to not worry so much about politics and just enjoy what I do with a clean and empty brain.
That's probably the best way to absorb everything.
I think so.
Without filters.
Yes.
And speaking of filters, what type of equipment do you use?
I'm a Canon person. Not by any other reason, not the Canon versus Nikon sort of rivalry that exists with some people. I think with a lot of people, it's what you start off with and what you use. I the first thing I ever bought was a Canon G2 point and shoot, and once I found that worked really well, I kind of just, this was back when I went from film to digital, when I was shooting horses. I supplemented my film cameras with a Canon G2 point and shoot, and then once I found that, oh, this is kind of cool, then it just went from there. I went and got a Canon D60 and then went up to the big stuff and really just added more stuff to my stuff. And
it does kind of tend to be a mountain where it just adds up. The more you know, the more you go.
It's frightening. And I'm glad my accountant, also known as my wife, keeps me in check with whether I buy stuff or not. So I have to run it by the accountant first now. So
yes, there's usually a boss somehow.
I look at our marriage and life together as a team. And so for me, the ultimate goal is that she can quit working and just travel with me everywhere. So that's what I want. I just want her to be able to write when she wants, and to travel with me.
Well, I can see definitely maybe something's in the future between the two of you with your photographs and her writing. It's possible maybe there'll be some more competition on the news shelves one day.
Well, I do have my little cycle world column as well, Liam. I do write as well, believe it or not. But I do Wheeler's World, which is on the cycleworld.com column, where I give a little unique perspective from behind the scenes of my own wacky world of photography. So
yes, I've read that. I remember seeing that, and I thought, that's Andy. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, if you'd like to visit my site and see some of my work and travels from races here in America and around the world, my site is www.automotophoto.com, and that's spelled AUTOMOTOPHOTO.com. And once again, my name is Andrew Wheeler, and thank you very much.
Awesome.
That was
Andrew,
great.
That was perfect.
That's perfect.
All right, mate.
Perfect. See you.
Well, Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Thank you, Liam. Cheers, Jules.
Ciao.
Ciao.
All right. That was great. Thanks to Andrew for taking the time to talk to us. And now, David Emmett has another piece for us to listen to. This time, it's his top five list from the 2006 season. Let's listen.
It's the end of the year, which traditionally means it's time to look back and weigh up the good and the bad. Somehow, what this usually means is that everyone has to draw up a bunch of lists. I'm not one to break with tradition, so here are mine. First of all, my top five MotoGP performers this year. I thought about having a top 10 MotoGP performers, but picking 10 riders would have meant picking more than half the regular field. And a top X list should at least have some kind of exclusivity. So, it's a top 5 instead. At number 5, Danny Pedrosa. If it wasn't for that little incident at Estoril, everyone would be full of praise for Pedrosa. 2006 was meant to be a learning year for him, but he learnt much faster than anyone expected, finishing on the podium in his first race and getting his first victory three races later. He demolished any doubts which people had about him by running consistently at the front all year. But as good as he was, his inexperience still showed. Some of his passing attempts were pretty uncontrolled, and he frequently complained about some of the tough passes Rossi and Capirossi put on him. Welcome to the big league, Danny. But his first year in MotoGP definitely left an impression. If Valentino Rossi starts playing mind games with you, then you're a factor in MotoGP. And the doctor focused nearly all of his voodoo on Pedrosa. Pedrosa has arrived and will only be better next year. At number 4, Marco Melandri. Marco Melandri left us with the image of 2006. His one-handed, high-speed power slide out of the last turn at Phillip Island. It was the epitome of hubris. Sheer, ballsy, look what I can do showmanship, and the fans loved it. But as well as these displays of pure genius, Marcio also showed us plenty of mediocrity. At some tracks he looked unbeatable, whereas at others he was lost mid-pack somewhere. And there was no obvious explanation for why he was good at one track and weak at the others. But there's no doubt about his talent, and if Melandri can find more consistency, he's going to be a hard man to beat. And at number 3, Loris Capirossi. How might the season have turned out if it hadn't been for their first corner mayhem at Catalunya? Up until Catalunya, Capirex had one win and three podiums from six races. During the last six races, once he'd recovered from his injuries, he had two wins and two seconds. He was definitely in form this year, as someone who'd witnessed the way he just walked away from the field at Brno and Motegi can tell you. He probably would have won at Sepang too, but the doctor found the only remedy for Capirossitis. Get in there, mix it up and stop him from getting away. But like Melandri, Capirossi wasn't good everywhere. While not quite as invisible as Melandri, when Loris couldn't get the bike to work, usually because of the Bridgestones, he was well off the pace. Once Bridgestone produced tyres which will work at every track the series visits, he's going to be a very tough nut to crack. And at number 2, Nicky Hayden. If Nicky Hayden is world champion, why isn't he number 1, I hear you ask? Well, it's not because I don't think Hayden is a worthy champion. Nicky Hayden was the very pinnacle of hard work and dedication this year, and his combination of consistency, gritty endurance and talent truly earned him the title. Where others made mistakes, Hayden kept his cool, put his head down, got the job done. The one complaint most often heard was that Hayden wasn't aggressive enough, preferring to play it safe. But at Assen, at Laguna, at Valencia and at Estoril until he got torpedoed, he showed he was capable of riding as hard and as fast as anyone. But once he took the lead in the championship, he focused on the one thing that mattered to him, becoming world champion. Hayden was ruthlessly efficient this year and thoroughly deserves his title. The good thing for Hayden fans is that now he has his title, he doesn't need to ride so defensively. I see him coming out next year with a point to prove that he can win races the hard way and not just play it safe. I think next year we'll see the real Nicky Hayden. And so, finally, number 1. The best riding of 2006, Valentino Rossi. Rossi was the only rider to match Hayden's consistency. Where Melandri and Capirossi had been brilliant and average by turns, Valentino Rossi was consistently inspired. He only made two mistakes this year, getting distracted by Formula 1 at the beginning of the year, which meant that Yamaha arrived at Jerez poorly prepared, and that untypically mediocre race at Valencia, when his title was on the line. If they'd have run the race on Saturday, Valentino would be champion. But they tried some things on Sunday morning, and it all went to pieces. But look at the other races. Knocked off at Jerez, fighting his way back through the field on an unwilling bike. Dominating in Qatar, Germany, Catalunya. Or lap 4 of the Phillip Island race, where he carved his way through the field as if they were standing still. Then, the breathtaking battles at Mugello and Sepang. I don't think Valentino Rossi has ever ridden better than this year. But, unfortunately for Rossi, it was not enough to make up for his laps in the pre-season. He was having to use all his talent just to try and keep up on a bike which was a long way behind the competition. And in trying to keep up, he pushed the bike too hard, destroying tyres at Shanghai and Laguna Seca, and suffering mechanical problems at Le Mans and Laguna. 3 DNFs scuppered the doctor's title chances by mid-season, and an uncharacteristic fit of nerves finished him off at Valencia. But to my mind, he was still the best rider of the series in 2006. Now, after the top five, a few of the high points and low points. First up, the coveted award of Best Australian, Chris Vermeulen. For me, Vermeulen has been the Rookie of the Year. He is calm, serious, dedicated, extremely talented, and has proved that he knows what it takes to develop a bike. A lot of people thought that he'd made the wrong choice by going to Suzuki instead of spending another year in superbikes and waiting till Honda decided he was ready for one of their satellite bikes. But Vermeulen has exceeded most people's expectations. He got a great podium at Phillip Island, and more importantly, had a fantastic race at Laguna Seca, which was only ruined by mechanical problems. If he had been on Casey Stoner's ride, I'm sure he would have got his first win this year. Now he'll just have to wait until 2007. Next up, a few honourable mentions. First of all, Carlos Checa. I'd more or less written Checa off at the end of the last season. He never really looked like he cared, but being dumped by the big money teams did wonders for his motivation. He seized the chance he was given with both hands, took a chatterplate Yamaha M1 and some standard tyres and turned them both around. He almost single-handedly got the Dunlop tyres into a position where they could start to be competitive. What's more, he's achieved his goals for the season, do well enough to secure a more competitive ride. An outstanding season for the Spaniard. Next, Alvaro Bautista, 125cc world champion. If you start breaking Valentino Rossi's records, people start taking you seriously. Bautista smashed Rossi's total points record and dominated the season. He's been promising to break through for a couple of years now, and this was his year. He goes for 250s for 2007, and he's definitely one to watch. Expect to be in MotoGP in 2009. In 250s, there was Hiroshi Aoyama on the KTM. Aoyama took a bike that was barely a year old and helped turn it into a machine to be feared, taking two wins in the process. He did a great job and showed that he has the maturity and determination to make it in MotoGP. Expect Aoyama in MotoGP in 2008, and expect him to be fast right from the start. Finally, I have to mention Troy Bayliss. By mid-season, he'd more or less wrapped up the Superbike champion in his first year back. In three full seasons of World Superbikes, he's won two titles and come second once. And then at Valencia, filling in for the injured Sete Gibernau, he turns up, takes pole and leads from start to finish, at the age of 37. A memorable performance, and you just know he's going to be the man to beat in Superbike next year. So, we've had the highs, now for the lows. Only two riders I want to mention as real disappointments. The first is Makoto Tomada, who's been virtually invisible all year. He had one good race in Germany, but was unlucky enough to be knocked off by Kenny Roberts Jr. Apart from that, he has been nowhere. It'll be good for him to get off the Michelins, because he just doesn't get along with them. But he will have to do better next year. And to wrap it all up, the winner of the Kropotkin Waste of Space Trophy for 2006 goes to José Luis Cardoso, as if you hadn't guessed. I have no idea what he was doing on the grid. He was never competitive, and he even got beaten by his temporary teammate Ivan Silva, a rider who had never been aboard a MotoGP machine before. He must have paid Luis Dantin a lot of money to ride those Ducatis, as there is no other earthly explanation for his presence on the paddock next year. So, those were my lists. Now back to Jules.
Okay, thanks again, David. Things have been fairly quiet since Valencia, but the MotoGP circus was far from checked out in November and December. With 2007 and the new bikes just around the corner, most of the crews went immediately back to work. We are now in the second week of the testing ban. The ban is a midwinter blackout during which no team is allowed to test their bikes on the track. Of course, this does not prevent teams from running tests inside their factories, running the motors on the dyno and such. And of course, the preseason is filled with the usual silly news that we've seen throughout the years, and although not quite as drama-filled as the silly season during which rider futures are determined in the closing half of the racing season, there's plenty of juicy bits running around the rumor mill. And one of these rumors is the possible addition of a second GP in the USA for the 2008 season. The current venue most likely to host this event is the famous, and I suppose infamous, Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Indianapolis, Indiana. Speedway officials have revealed that they were hoping to have motorcycle racing back at the racetrack by 2009, the 100th anniversary of the Speedway, as the first ever race event held at Indianapolis was, in fact, a motorcycle race held in 1909. Ever since rumors of the additional event surfaced, those familiar with the track layout have been debating the feasibility of running a modern motorcycle race at the decidedly automobile racing driven design of the racetrack. The specific concern that has been raised is the lack of runoff and the banked corners of the existing outside oval. The Formula One circuit at Indianapolis is the most obvious choice for reuse in MotoGP. However, even that mostly infield track still uses a section of the oval. In fact, in 2005, the banked corners were the primary reason for the tire scandal during which during the Formula One USGP, when all Michelin shot cars pulled out of the race just before the start, leaving just six competitors who ran on Bridgestones. The primary issue is the high-speed right turn at the end of the oval section, because there's no runoff and instead, quite literally, a solid wall on the outside of the racetrack. The solution being discussed is to run the race anti-clockwise and to create a new left turn just following the pit exit. But from what I heard, it's actually unclear whether the racetrack officials are talking about using the existing left-hand turn or building a new one further infield, thus allowing the outside to be used as runoff. It doesn't seem to make sense to use the existing banked corner, since the lack of runoff would be pretty much the same as in the clockwise direction. But the important thing is that with Nicky Hayden as world champion, all involved parties see the U.S. as an even juicier market. However, I have to say that I've been quite disappointed about the lack of Nicky Hayden recognition in America. Even at the International Motorcycle Show that I attended last week in the Bay Area, there was very little Hayden noise. Honda did not seem to take advantage of the interests of the audience, providing a small HRC booth and only CBR replicas of the Repsol Honda. In fact, only Yamaha made real effort to reach out to the MotoGP fanbase by bringing Rossi's Camel Yamaha M1 to the show. And incidentally, it was the Jerez edition of the bike without the colorful Doctor insignia. Anyway, back to Indy. The good news for real GP fans is that if Indianapolis does host a MotoGP event, we may finally get to see the supporting 125 and 250 classes, which have been excluded from 2005, 2006, and 2007 rounds at Laguna Seca. It seems unlikely that these classes would skip two American events. Also, if they do run the track anti-clockwise, it'll fall in nicely with the U.S. tradition, that being mostly left-handed racetracks. Thus, another event for the left corner happy Nicky Hayden. But anyway, that's all conjecture at this point. I'm sure we'll be learning more and more as 2008 approaches. For now, let's get back to the season at hand. This week, Dorna has finally announced the official rider entry list. So we've got Repsol Honda with Nicky Hayden and Danny Pedrosa, and it will be interesting, to say the least, watching how that relationship shapes up in 2007. Fortuna Gresini has Marco Melandri and Tony Elias, Elias probably getting the ride as a direct result of his miracle performance at Estoril in the penultimate round, when he beat Valentino Rossi at the last corner, crossing the finish line just 0.02 of a second in front. Wow. Kateka Minolta Honda gets Shinya Nakano, who replaces Tamara, while LCR Honda gets Carlos Checa, who replaces Casey Stoner. The Yamaha Racing Team lineup once again includes Valentino Rossi and Colin Edwards in the official team. Tech 3 Yamaha, on the other hand, has an all-new lineup featuring Makoto Tomada and rookie Sylvain Guintoli. Kawasaki retain Randy Depunier and add 2005's China podium finisher and longtime Kawasaki tester and collaborator Olivier Jacques. Rizla Suzuki made no changes, so we'll continue seeing John Hopkins and Christopher Mullen, and based on the preseason data, this should be a fantastic season for the Rizla boys. Rumors of a second Team KR rider have now pretty much proven unlikely, but Kenny Jr. will continue working with his father's team. Let's hope they can get that Honda motor married to their chassis soon. In the non-Japanese manufacturer section of the grid, Marlboro Ducati fields Loris Caparossi and Casey Stoner. Caparossi is rumored to have asked for quite a sizable raise to his season salary, and there was even a serious consideration of letting him go. However, that seemed to have worked itself out. Frankly, I can't see how Ducati could release Loris. The Desmo Sudici was practically built around and for Caparossi, and his 2006 performance was nothing short of stunning. I think the team most likely to raise eyebrows in 2007's Pramac Dantin MotoGP, who now featured the experienced veteran Alex Barros. The other Alex, Alex Hoffman, keeps his seat he had in 2006. Because Dantin is running a GP7 and Bridgestone's tires, just like the Ducati factory team, there's a very good chance we'll see a lot more than a fight for 15th place from them. And Ilmor took their time announcing their lineup. In fact, they seem to have missed the press release deadline from Dorna. They were not included in the Dorna announcement, but later in the same day made public their own release, announcing the signing of Andrew Pitt and Jeremy McWilliams. There's been a lot of speculation about Gary McCoy, who has been tied to the project since the Ilmor bike was announced. The latest ramblings, or rumblings, I've heard point to either McCoy asking for too much money or his rear tire sliding style being too opposed to the bike's design. But, you know, with politics in MotoGP the way they are, it's hard to say. It's great to see this lineup, especially since the grid has gained a new team. I remember when I first read about the move to 800s in 2007, I was concerned that due to the high cost of developing an all-new bike, we may actually lose teams during the first 800 season. Thankfully, it looks like those fears were unfounded. Okay, that's the end of episode 72. Thank you very much for downloading the show, and please help spread the word that MotoGPOD is back. Also, please check out the website at MotoGPOD.com, as I've got a bunch of episode 72 relevant links up there for you to click on. Happy holidays, happy new year, and once again, I want to thank Colin Edwards, Andrew Wheeler, David Emmett, and of course Liam Schubert. Thanks for downloading the podcast, and catch you next time. Ciao.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.